Joining me back on the program today is Peter Lavelle, the host of Crosstalk on RT. The last time we did a show, it was quite popular. Why do you think that kept getting reposted over and over again? People sick of the mass media?
Look, maybe because people just want to hear the truth. That's what I think.
Well, I see from a lot of comments, people just want to hear two people who know what they're talking about having a discussion about politics, because it's so rare to get that in the mainstream media. Western media is basically garbage. People yelling catchphrases and literally reading teleprompters and reissuing talking points over and over again uniformly. It's just disgusting, and people aren't that stupid. They see through it.
I think it's interesting. What you just said is what the most common thing I heard. It's nice to hear. Was nice to listen to two people that knew what they were talking about, because you and I both know. You watch this cable network news, and it's just, these people know everything about everything. That's amazing, and you're always wrong. It's extraordinary.
Well, today should be just as popular as before.
It was very popular. We covered a lot of ground, but I think, if I remember correctly, we spent most of our time on Ukraine, and I think we'll do that again today. I was doing a recording on Ukraine on Thursday this past week, and we left the studio. And my crew said, "Have you seen the news?" And I said, "Which news?" And I said, "Well, Western news." And they said, "No, what happened?" They said, "Russia invaded Ukraine." And I said, "What?" Everybody's looking at each other, scratching their heads, like, "What?" And it was just, again, it's to the point of depressing here. Depressing. Is everything is just made out of thin air. I've never seen a story like it.
Oh, I've seen stories like it. I remember CNN doing a report on Iraq from Florida claiming to be in Saudi Arabia. 10 guys have invaded Ukraine. Russia is invading because 10 men were picked up on the unmarked border between the two countries. That has to constitute an invasion, Peter. Everyone knows you launch your first strike capacity with 10 people.
You know, but let's be clear. Let's be clear about this. Let's be clear about those 10 guys and other guys. Think about it logically. This is a country that is collapsing. Its social order is collapsing. Its military order is in a disastrous situation. It's incumbent upon Russia to have eyes and ears on the ground in a neighboring country that is going into collapse. Right? And when these soldiers were apprehended, you know what the first thing they did? They pulled out their ID card and they presented it. They were not fighting. They weren't shooting anything. They were looking around. And that's perfectly normal in a situation like this. They were not involved in hostilities. And there is, with all of the military technology and all the intelligence technology, they can't produce one photograph of these allegations. Not one photograph. They have these commercial satellites up in the air. They produce these grainy little pictures that say nothing. It's remarkable that NATO is using these grainy little pictures from a commercial outfit saying this is evidence of an invasion. It's ludicrous.
What I don't understand is this is the boy who cried wolf. Every time they come up with some massive, scary claim like the Russians are coming, it gets debunked. And month after month, they've been proven to lie over and over again. Not just be mistaken, but just outright lie. They can't even fabricate evidence for their claims.
The sad thing is here is that the echo chamber in the West and the empty minds in the halls of power, they're not looking at this logically. Number one, they're trusting everything the Kiev regime says, which the Kiev regime, going all the way back to February, every step of the way, pathological liars. Pathological liars. It's hard to trust anything they say. Number two, if Russia had wanted to invade Ukraine, it could have easily done that a long time ago and been successful, at least militarily. Now, would there have been people on the ground that perceived it as an occupation? Of course there would be. And that's one of the primary reasons why Russia hasn't intervened on a right to protect doctrine, because they still know that in these areas, that it's not 100% Russian. It's not even sometimes 20% Russian. It's a real mixture in the East. And there's ethnic cleansing going on now. It's getting less and less Russian. We're looking at about close to 1 million refugees now, which is never a million people. Imagine that. A million people have been displaced.
Well, in the little reporting that was done on that, the Western media claimed that, oh, those million people, they're just visiting their families, all of them.
That is just extraordinary. It is extraordinary. As I was I had a meeting with a good colleague of mine yesterday, and we were sitting having coffee, and I said to him, I said, look at these buildings around us. These are exactly the kinds of buildings that are a few hundred miles away from us that are being bombed by planes and missiles. The architecture is the same. The same type of people live there, and no one is talking about it in the West. It is really catastrophic from a moral point of view. Okay, and we go back one more third reason. Russia is not interested in the geographical location of the Donbass, which is known as the regions of East Ukraine. It's a humanitarian issue that Russia has been most primarily interested in. However, if we go down the path of the junta in Kiev that was going to push for NATO membership, then we get into a truly catastrophic security situation. Russia has very few red lines in its foreign policy, but NATO membership for Ukraine would be one. And then we're into a very different ballgame and a very dangerous one. I hope it's just rhetoric coming out of Kiev right now. But we do have a meeting of NATO coming up on the 5th of September. So we'll see where that goes.
Normally, NATO wouldn't add countries that are in the middle of a conflict. That would just be asking for it, right?
Well, it would be against NATO's charter. But we both know, and our listeners know, that that doesn't stop particularly the United States from breaking international law and breaking its own rules. If you look carefully at the charter of NATO, they're not supposed to do that. But they just may fiddle with it, okay? And we are hearing that some NATO countries, the European countries, are going to put together a 10,000 member quick reaction force or something like that. You know, if it stations those troops in Ukraine again, it's going to be a very serious red line. I think if you look backwards from the crisis that started in February all the way to the present, the Russian side, the Russian foreign ministry, and the Russian president, their words and actions reflect the same thing. It doesn't come out of Washington and certainly out of Kiev. So when they say this is a very serious thing and don't do it, it should be listened to.
Do you think it's necessary for Poroshenko to say Russia, Russia, Russia over and over again and paint this like it's just ethnic Russians versus the state? Because without being able to point the finger at Russia, I think they've painted this whole situation the wrong way. There are plenty of people in Ukraine who are not ethnic Russians who are rebelling because they don't want to live under another oligarch that's 15 billion euros in debt.
Absolutely.
So might it not then be necessary that they have to blame Russia? Otherwise, they can't explain why there's such a popular uprising against the oligarchical government, which was selected and imposed from outside. Nobody would want to live under such a regime.
It's really interesting is because what the Poroshenko regime, the junta in Kiev, they do not want to admit, and Washington will not admit, that this is a civil war that's being played out. See, if they say, no, it's Russia's fault. If Russia would just back off and do this and do that, then everything will be peaceful in eastern Ukraine, which is nonsense, absolute nonsense. People on this side of the border in Russia, a lot of people are disappointed that Russia hasn't done a lot more. I believe that Putin has a plan. It's a long-term plan where there will be decentralization and federalization of Ukraine. But you're absolutely right. Poroshenko is lost. See, a few days ago, they had an independence parade in Kiev. And it was supposed to mark the end of the civil war, the marking the success of the junta throughout of Ukraine. And you know what? They spent their last pennies on that parade because they're broke. They have no money. And they spent their money on this ridiculous parade, which was supposed to be a victory parade for Poroshenko and the junta. And it didn't work out that way. As you know, as a matter of fact, nothing there is working out as planned. Victoria Nuland is just really one crazy strategist, because this was a dumb idea in the beginning, and it's just cascading into one big clusterfuck for the U.S. and for Europe. And look, the average European vegetable and fruit producer, I mean, what did they do? Who do they care about? Do they care about Ukraine? They care about their markets. And there's great consumers here. I mean, the cascade effect is extraordinary. It was never thought out.
This was not a popular uprising by any means. It was pushed on from the outside. You've got a bunch of billionaires and their NGOs playing around with Ukraine like it's just a playground or something for them, manipulating energy and agriculture and different resources, and they don't care about the populace at all. Not at all. They're supporting neo-Nazis even. Can Ukraine really recover and heal after this, or has too much damage already been done?
Well, the thing is what's going to happen is that, you know, Ukraine as a country, as it was a year ago, will never be the same. If hostilities ended today, Ukraine is still a very, very different place. It's going to be impossible for the folks of the East. You know, I know these countries really well. I've spent most of my life in Slavic countries, in Poland, in Russia. There's a long memory here. You bombed my building. You took away my job. Because I speak Russian or because I was born of Russian parents, you did that to me. There's no forgiveness for that for a long time, because these people, they didn't have a very strong identity about Ukraine or about Russia. Their identity was, we're from here. We're locals. Everything has changed now. Now they have a great sense of Russian pride, and they know their Russian heritage. Poroshenko and the junta did that. Before that, there was a phrase for them. They were Soviet people. They didn't have any particular, you know, orientation, because they were kind of a mistake or an oversight of the Soviet Union that so many millions of Russians ended up on that side of the border. That's all changed right now. And your point about the NGOs and, you know, this is just God's playground for them. Well, it's turning into one big cemetery. And it's, again, comes all the way from Brussels and Washington. I cannot emphasize enough how artificial this crisis is. But it's a crisis that has consequences that will be with us for a long time.
Could things escalate, or are they going to maintain the status quo level of violence they think they can control?
I think it's going to simmer. I think it's going to simmer for a long time. And, you know, Western media doesn't want to talk about it, but this is turning into a magnet for people that want to, you know, these weekend warriors or whatever on both sides. I saw a very interesting report about how some French, you know, a few dozen French men armed have made their way to the Donbass. And then you have these Swedish Nazis working for the junta. This is really getting to be insane here, because it's turning into a huge proxy war. And I think what's going to happen is that when the U.S. really wants to separate Europe from Russia, but at the end of the day, that Russia and Europe, they really need each other for at least trade. Values, I think the two are going in very different directions. But for practical things, I think that, you know, Merkel and others are going to say, no, we can't go any further down this path here. And there's going to be a lot of pressure on them from Washington, from the Nuland people. I think, as we said in our last chat here, Victoria Nuland, they got about 2 years to wrap this thing up, their whole agenda with ISIS, with Ukraine, and Syria, et cetera, et cetera. They may not have the same kind of clout in Washington that they have now, because, you know, Obama is just an AWOL president when it comes to foreign policy. I mean, he doesn't even make any sense when he's reading the teleprompter. He's completely unbelievable. So they need to wrap this up quickly. And for Ukraine, they don't have any solutions. They're in panic mode. That's why they keep saying invasion, invasion, invasion. That's the default position when they don't know what to do.
Well, they've got a lot of money and supposedly a bunch of smart guys. They went to school. I don't know if they just paid for their diplomas or what, but you think, can't they come up with better rhetoric than this, than saying the Russians are coming, it's an invasion every day? Because what happens tomorrow when, of course, there was no invasion, and they do that 2-3 times in a row? What's the matter with them? They can't even get a good lie going.
Well, it's I don't know. I mean, I always feel that in my life that I didn't read enough fiction. I've always been a nonfiction guy. I liked history and philosophy and stuff like that. But I guess I have my opportunity to make up for my loss of fiction. Just watch CNN because that's all you get is just the echo chamber.
If you want to catch up on your fiction, I suggest maybe the New York Times. I hear that's a good one.
Well, the thing is that if you look at you have the anti-Kiev resistance on the ground. They're getting stronger and stronger. They're getting more and more experienced. Their confidence is high. Their morale is high. They're getting a lot of their equipment from the Ukrainian army in retreat or in disarray. In this part of the world, stowing away, hiding away arms is not that hard. Okay, there's been a long history of that from the 1950s. The Vendetta people were doing that in the 50s until they were completely wiped out. And this is like 7, 8 years after the Second World War ended, and they were still fighting them. So there's a tradition in this part of the world here. This equipment, Russia, does it, some of it come from Russia? Yes, it does. I call them the lords of war. There are people making money hand over fist on this. They always do on both sides. Let's not kid ourselves. On both sides.
Yes, during the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a huge black market on weapons trade because that's one thing they had already spent money on and it physically existed as hardware. And so there was a lot of black market, again, coming from the oligarchs selling them to the highest bidder after the ruble overhang. The currency was worthless, so they were bargaining and trading and getting rid of armored vehicles and everything else. So that stuff is all over the place and it's not hard to hide. But a lot of it's obsolete. It's from the 50s. My favorite story this week was taking out an entire Russian column in the middle of the night. And they took the babies off the incubators and they threw them on the cold floor.
Well, I have not seen. It's our job to watch what's going on, to read what's being written about. I mean, I haven't seen one photograph of that. And these two gentlemen, what was it, Mr. Oliphant and Mr. Walker? I mean, I know both of them personally, and I have to really wonder what's going through their mind when they would be writing these stories. When you have GPS and you have everything else and you can figure out they're not telling the truth. I was really hurt. I know that they have their own agenda. That's fine. I have my agenda, okay? But coming to the conclusion, the two people that I know working in media openly lied. That's really painful because, we have to, I stick to the truth. That's what makes my job so hard because no one gets to hear the truth in Western media about these topics. So, when there are two people that,
But usually the American neocons are a little bit better with their lies than what Kiev has been doing. The neocon strategy, normally the process is to make the other side have to prove a negative, which is a logical fallacy. So they'll say, prove you're not doing X, and then of course that cannot be done and never satisfied. But Kiev's lies have been very low level because they've been saying things that are provably debunkable, that are demonstrably false. Like, for example, when they say, we knocked out an entire Russian column at night with artillery from the 50s. The first thing you gotta ask is, okay, well, where's the carnage? Where are the blown up pieces of machines and things? You didn't just evaporate them, so if you took out this column, where's the column?
Yeah, but no one asked him that question. Only you and I would ask those questions. Because CNN will say, yeah, they'll just say, well, the Kiev government said that, and that must be true because the Kiev government said it. I mean, it gets self-referential. It's just ridiculous.
But don't they know that their lie is going to be debunked? Have they no shame? They just figure they can move on to the next one and people will forget the original one. They've been doing it over and over again. Where is the carnage? Where is the forensic evidence?
Well, where's the evidence for the Malaysian aircraft? What's the only country in the world continuing to say we want the evidence? Where is the forensic evidence? It's Russia. Russia can go to their foreign ministry website. They continue to ask questions why the authorities in Britain are not releasing more information, why the Ukrainians, after all this time, have not released any of the data that they have about communication between the pilot and the tower in Kiev. That evidence exists, but it won't be.
I think there's guilt in the silence because we know they have forensic evidence. There's no way they weren't monitoring the skies that night, and yet they won't tell us or show us any of that evidence, and that pretty much shows that it doesn't fit their narrative, so they don't want to share it.
Yeah, we know who did it now, don't we? Just by default, because you're not going to tell us. Well, there must be a reason why you don't want to tell us, because your narrative that you spun, I'm talking about Western media and Western capitals, particularly John Kerry and the American State Department, hours after that plane went down, the Russians did it, the Russians did it. On five different network television programs, John Kerry pointed the finger at Russia. It was less than 20.
And they intercepted communications that, oops, were from the day before the plane was hit.
Yep. And now it's just dropped out. I'm sorry, that's kind of a pathetic pun at this point, but it just dropped out of the sky. It's really amazing. But I guess they're just counting on the fact that, first of all, anything that Russia does must be evil, okay? That's what they're counting on. This is what's really painful for me, is that I was brought up in the United States, and I went to Eastern Europe when I was 20, 21, and then I started living in Russia in my 30s. And when I came here, I was Russophobic, very much, because I was taught to be. And then after about 2 years of living here, I just realized we were afraid of this place. Why? It's not threatening at all. But see, they just keep playing upon that tradition that we were brought up with, and it's really powerful. It's like heroin. It really is. And when you go through the withdrawal, everything you realize, everything you've been told is a lie. It's a bad experience.
You just need to watch Rocky III a few more times. That's what your problem is, Peter.
Oh, man.
Or was it Rocky IV, maybe?
I think it was four, but I mean, Russians to this day always like to say, "I remember the ending. Remember the ending? Was that little bin Laden that you guys invented or something like that?" It's hilarious. Yeah, but see, this is what it's all about.
Well, in Rambo, one of the Rambos, they were
I'm sorry?
one of the Rambos, they were helping the Mujahideen in the film.
Yeah, at the very end, they're like, what's the helicopter, battle there? And then there's a little kid there with the goat or donkey and thanking Rambo. I guess they should have been to be continued, okay? But no, this is what happens. It's happening all over again, all the time, this law of unintended consequences. And I have to say that it's intentional on one level. Just keep churning it up, churning it up. And keep changing the positions of everyone. Keep everyone off guard.
Do you think they wanted the coup to go a lot smoother, but as Ray McGovern said, their backup plan B was, well, if it fails, we can still wreck the place, and that's good enough. It doesn't hurt us.
Yeah, I mean, particularly for the Americans, because there's almost no downside when you look at Ukraine, right? I mean, they're not worried about oranges and cabbage, right? They're not. But a lot of Europeans are, and the Europeans with just a very, very fragile economy in the EU, very fragile. And then having this come along, this is really bad news. But for the average American consumer, they're not going to hear anything about it whatsoever because they don't even have real fruit and vegetables anymore. Okay, so you don't have to worry about it.
Well, Monsanto was buying grain elevators before the coup began, so somebody knew something.
Just pick away. It's not even a corpse yet, and just start picking away at it. Just like Hunter, the son of the vice president. Okay, he's Hunter is out there going to get all the gas and oil contracts too. It's so pathetic. It's really, really pathetic being an American sometimes here and explaining to people what the U.S. government's trying to do. Which I always say, I don't really know what they're trying to do, but they're really screwing everything up. And it's an interesting thing too, is that the animosity towards the United States and Russia right now is very high. I've seen it in the amount of time that I've lived here. It just, they keep asking me, why are you guys so arrogant? Why are you so pushy? Why don't you want to talk to people? Why can't you communicate like adults with people instead of just forcing all the time? And I said, that's our genetic code when it comes to foreign policy. Particularly since the end of the Cold War. These victory laps, they're still taking them. It's morbid.
Well, I think a monster was created during World War II because, unlike Europe and Asia, who destroyed themselves, the US didn't lose any cities. They weren't taken over. They didn't really suffer or see the reality of war the way the European and Asian continents and Africa did. And so they just continued this machine. It was an emergency situation where weapons companies got a lot of support and money, and they never let go. They went right into the war in Korea after that. They had conflict after conflict all the way up until this recent reinvasion of Iraq. So I think for a lot of these strategists, it's just a game. It's an intellectual puzzle on how to steal from people and murder people, and they don't see the real human cost of what they're doing, and they don't care.
But it's really remarkable. You're right. You're right. But you know what? The U.S. military can't win wars anymore. It's really interesting. Look at it. You can't win. All of the billions and billions of dollars. What's the latest estimate that Iraq costs $3 trillion in the end? And they can't even win that. It's a third world country. You know, this is not a military power. The U.S. only picks on weak countries. Look at Libya. You know, they can't defend themselves against...
13 years in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, exactly, you know.
But I would argue that winning's not the goal.
I agree. And that's why we get this fiction. You know, when the U.S. goes into military action, what does CNN do? Oh, let's take a look at this aircraft here. Let's look at its specs here. And they have them flying around, and it's like a video game. It's so cool looking, and there's never any dead bodies. No, 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 no. War is fun. War is a video game. War is what we pay for.
When they want to win a war against a third world country and blow it apart, it's like Grenada. It's over in a day. But I'm saying this because the neocons have written it out and told us this is their plan, is that the purpose of war is no longer to get a single resource like gold or tea or oil or something. That's old thinking. War itself is the resource. The more wars become mechanized and mechanical, the more expensive the toys have become. And you're talking about billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in these industries. All they need is a pretext and a conflict. That's all they're really concerned about, is protracted war.
But it's good, you know, this is what's making the neocons and the Victorian Newlands so furious, is because they hit a brick wall. It's called Ukraine, because this is Ukraine is part of Russia's existential security. And don't bluff, don't mess with Russia, don't screw with Russia, particularly don't lie to Russia when it comes to the fate of Ukraine. Because as we say back in America, dem are fighting words, okay? And this is what's really scary to me, because Putin is a despot, and Putin's a dictator, and Putin's all this, no one in Western media likes to remember the fact or even know the fact that Putin has popularity. He's measured by opinion polls. You know, he looks at the polls, and what is he doing? Yeah, but, you know, he just can't sit on his thumbs and watch Ukraine collapse. He can't. That would be very bad for his public opinion approval numbers. And he knows it. And that's why he keeps sticking up for the right thing to do in relation to Ukraine, which I think he's done a remarkable job under all this pressure and all this. I mean, I'm sure he's told about it. I know his press people pretty well. And I know that they show him things like newspapers and websites and stuff like that. And, you know, he's a pretty demonized guy, but I've met him. He's a pretty tough guy, too. But this is an enormous amount of pressure here. So, again, you know, I agree with you, all of the examples that we gave about, you know, overturning governments and prolonged conflicts. But when it gets to Ukraine, this is going to be very different. And I think this is what's frustrating the Washington people. That's why they go to the invasion mode so quickly, so easily, because they know that the plan hasn't worked. It's not working. And as the militias in the East get more skillful and more confident, I don't know. I don't want to brush off my crystal ball at the moment. But, you know, they could start saying, look, you know, we can move. We can start pushing them out now. We don't have to defend. We can push. And the morale of the Ukrainian military is really, really low right now. I mean, to the point where officers threaten to shoot their own troops if they don't fight. That's when you get to the rock bottom, right? And you have the militias in the East is one encirclement after another, even to the point where they'll say, we'll let you go. We'll let you go free. Just go to Russia, drop off your weapons, and you'll find your way back home. We don't need to keep you here. We don't want to have you prisoner. You're not hostages. Just drop your arms, cross the border. We'll get you on a plane, and we'll take you back to your families, okay? Let's get this thing over with. That's the Russian side. Have you heard any of that in Western media? Hardly at all.
I understand what the US and a little bit the UK is doing because they're not as economically tied, but why are the rest of the Europeans committing economic suicide? It's completely against their own interests. They're going to run out of gas. They're going to have to pay more for food. It's not in their interests at all to obey. Going along with this, is it just the fear of the Americans or what?
I think it's just the fear of the U.S., unfortunately. I mean, you can. I have a number of German friends, good friends, and they tell me, and I agree with them to a great degree, that there are occupied countries. Okay, there are a lot of people in Germany that don't want to have anything to do with NATO. You don't hear that often, but it's true. Germany has lost so much of its sovereignty here, and there's a lot of pressure on the Germans to toe the line. And the British will do it because they always believe that they have to be on the side of the Americans to be relevant in the world. If they're on the wrong side of the Americans, they'll feel like the Americans won't throw them a bone the next time. So it's much more intimidation than anything else. But if you go back to the last parliamentary elections earlier this year in Europe, being anti-Russia, being Russophobic was not a goal, a vote getter. And I think that they're going to have to start recalibrating this because it doesn't work. The average French voter doesn't really care much about Russia, but if you're saying, we're going to lose jobs because of Russia, then a lot of people say, well, then why are we treating Russia in this way? And who cares about the Ukraine that you people have engineered a disaster in? I think there's going to be definitely some blowback here, particularly if it's going to be a really cold winter, and we have the agricultural sector in Europe is hit very, very badly. I think there will be repercussions in Europe itself. The Americans they don't have a learning curve. They just it just. They'll say it's the Russians' fault and just keep pounding away. Make sure CNN and Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post keep echoing that every single day. And that, from an American perspective, that will be all right. But you're right. It'll be very interesting how it plays out in Europe.
Is Europe just going to be reactionary? They're going to wait for the cold winter to come and then say, wow, I'd like my gas back, and then react? Or might they be proactive?
What's really sad too is that, again, for the Europeans, it's to the point of just embarrassment, is that Kiev will just steal the gas that is supposed to go to Europe. They've done it before. Very, very often they do it. They steal from the Europeans. The Europeans have already paid for that gas. That's their gas. And so here's the absurdity of it all. The Berlin and Brussels, and London, they back this junta, and this junta is stealing gas that is destined for European customers to make their tea in the morning. I mean, this is the absurdity of it all. And they will steal it. Believe me, they do it all the time. The pipeline system, if you study it, it's in dreadful condition. excuse me, the Ukrainians haven't taken care of it at all. And it's one of the reasons why the Russians wanted to buy it. And they wanted to buy it outright because it's in dreadful condition. And Russia is very dependent on the European consumer to sell its gas. People forget that side of the equation all of the time. Energy as a political weapon it doesn't really make any sense. A logical person will say no one's a winner because Russia needs the money. Why would it do that? Why would it, slit its own throat out of spite? The Russians are far more pragmatic than that, believe me.
Isn't the US just pushing Russia into the arms of China, which is exactly what they didn't want to happen by cutting them off from Europe? I mean, this is not thought out very well.
The thing is that it's there's a number of things in play right now. It's obviously, if the West really wants to use Ukraine as this surrogate to cause trouble constantly for Russia's modernization, because that's what President Putin is all about. He's about modernizing Russia. That will be his greatest legacy for smart people that know what's going on here. He will be the great modernizer. And to continue that modernization, if the West doesn't want to cooperate and they want to pick fights all the time, they will turn to the East. And then the values. It's just more and more people in Russia that I know, they like going to Venice, they like going to London, they like the Swiss watches, they like those kind of things, but they don't like the value system. And that turns a lot of people off in Russia, the bearded women and insulting the traditional family. Russians are amazingly tolerant people. They really are. But they don't like to be forced to accept other people's values as better than theirs. And it's getting a lot of traction in Russia right now. The Chinese don't push any agenda on anybody. They just want trade. I mean, they're mercenaries when it comes to trade, and they're good at it. but they don't have any package deal. And the Russians prefer have a lot more comfort with that. That's why they can deal with countries in the Middle East a lot easier, because they don't bring any this agenda that, along with them. And Russia just is much more hands off when it comes to those things. But they want their values and lifestyle to be respected. Europe doesn't do that. Europe looks down on Russia, and they don't. Russians are a proud people. They don't like that.
You know, Europeans look down on everyone. Americans are very pushy with the value system as well.
Yeah, but it's hypocritical, okay, all the time. I mean, boycotting the Sochi Games because of a ridiculous law about the protection of minors in Russia when it comes to non-traditional marriages and relationships and whatnot. But and at the same time, in Saudi Arabia is one of America's greatest allies, and they behead people for that kind of thing. It's just extraordinarily hypocritical, and that really irks a lot of people right here. You use all these fake foreign policy agendas when there are states in the United States. You know the Russian law. Your listeners might find this curious. The law on this anti-gay law, as it's called, it's a direct translation from laws coming from the United States. It's not even a uniquely Russian law. A lawmaker saw it, could speak English, and said, hey, we ought to have that, and they wrote it into Russian. It comes from the United States, like Alabama or something like that.
Well, the U.S.'s own states, like Kansas, have far worse laws, and they're not from way back in the day. They're from modern times.
Yeah, but that's, I always say, and I like to, as I explain to my Russian friends, I mean, there's a certain cultural war being fought out in the United States, and it's peculiar to the United States. And I like to think of myself as a tolerant person. I'm not against gay people. I am not at all. People make their own choices. What I don't like is it always being, it has to be equal to everything else. And I said, no, that's not true. I have my value system. They're not exactly the same, but I'm not going to deny someone their right to be with someone. That's their business, okay? And it should be respected under law, like with medical insurance and inheritance and things like that. But don't tell me it's exactly the same thing. And then when the United States turns around and says to everybody in the world, we're going to punish you and sanction you and humiliate you because you don't have the same opinion as the U.S. State Department, then that's wrong, okay? And people see it as being wrong, particularly when there are other countries around the world that are fantastically homophobic, and the United States never says a word about it, okay? That's called hypocrisy.
Well, I'll give you a nice cultural example. Here in Japan, families bathe with their children communally, all in the bathtub together. They also have communal baths that you don't have to go to, but they're available because nudity just isn't as big of a deal. However, in the U.S., that would be illegal. If you took a bath with your child after the age, I don't know what the line is, 5, 6, 7, something like that, you could be accused of pedophilia, even though it's your own son or daughter. And yet in Asia, there are not 120 million pedophile Japanese people. They just take a bath. It's natural, and it's not thought of in a sexual way. But I think there might be a little bit of projecting from the folks who are accusing everybody of being pedophiles or whatever. There's a lot of problems with sexuality in the West. Why in the world would sex be the first thing on your mind when you're talking about giving kids a bath?
In my value system too, and I think that one has to serve by example and not with a big mouth. You see how other people live. You can and traditions change. Let's not have everything in cement. Some there are good traditions. Sometimes there are bad ones. But in your community, you have to deal with those issues. And I really believe it's very local here. But I think there's common sense, you would condemn the tyrannical rule of the House of Saud. I mean, by any definition of society. But no, you won't get that. I mean, it's interesting is that you're not supposed to say bad things about Israel and Western media, but you're not supposed to say anything about Saudi Arabia.
Well, certainly. And anytime someone defends culture, the pseudo counterargument is to say, ah, so just cultural relativism, nothing's ever right or wrong. And I'll just throw some David Hume at that. You pick a particular aim at the goal, and that which does not lead to creating the goal, which you stated within your own value system was your target, is therefore wrong. Saudi Arabia is a great example. I mean, they don't even let women drive cars. It's a horrible society. It's totally unjustifiable because the rationalizations for it stem back to fictional stories about magical creatures and things. I could care less if someone's gay or not, or asexual, or hypersexual, or whatever. Just don't have the state picking a winner and loser in the marketplace of ideas and enforcing one over all the others.
Exactly. And the same thing in Russia, the Banya culture. In the winter, when people go out to the Banya and it's really hot, and there's a lot of nudity, there's some drinking. You shouldn't drink in those conditions, but people do it anyway. And it's not sexual at all. It's about the celebration of winter and being getting warm, being cleansed. There's a real cleansing element to it all. But when people see, you know, pictures of it, they instantly think one thing, and they're projecting. They're projecting their, you know, dirty mind onto somebody else.
I give another example. There was a 5-year-old Native American boy in Texas who went to his first day of school, and the principal had him return home because they said his hair is too long and that boys should have short hair.
Yeah, I saw that. You know, but at the same time in California, if I get my facts correct here, it's already gone down to elementary school where you know it's optional what toilet you can go to, the boys' room or the girls' room, irrespective of your gender. And then you won't let a boy, a Native American boy, that part of their culture and tradition is to have long hair. I mean, you and I, when we think of, you know, a kind of a stereotype of an Indian, you know, when I think of an Indian, they have long hair, right? I mean, that's...
It's one thing to say, this is a boy, this is a girl, based on organs. That's perfectly fine, and anyone trying to deny that's a little Fruit Loopy. But then to start ascribing fashion styles and things, particularly to males are all this way and think this way, behavioral patterns to DNA, saying, oh, well, girls have long hair, boys have short hair, especially when that's not even true in the Native American culture, and his parents were good and saying, hey, look, this is our tradition and this is how he wants to look, and it's his hair, by the way. You shouldn't send him home for something like that. But people tend to be one or the other. They either want extreme rigid rules where they ascribe behavior to where, like, you have to, if you're black, you gotta talk black and you gotta dress black, and be like, what the hell does that even mean? What is it? So if someone's speaking a different way, they're acting white. That kind of stuff is ridiculous. As is on the other side, where they say there's no borders, even when somebody clearly has a penis, and you say, well, he's not a boy if he doesn't think he's a boy. No, you're a boy if you're a boy, and there's nothing prejudiced about that. But they're so scared of judgment that they can't even make clear common sense judgments, whereas on the other side, they're absolutely the opposite, wacky in the other direction. So much stupidity going around. Even if he wasn't Native American, it still doesn't matter. Who cares if his hair is long? I guarantee they didn't send any girls home for having short hair, if that happened to be the case.
Yeah. Well, I guess this, the humiliation and then degradation of Native Americans just continues. Just continues to this day. It's really quite extraordinary. Well, I mean, it's interesting is that it's almost turned upside down. I mean, I look at a young boy like that. He has a strong cultural identity and tradition. I was brought up with McDonald's and Madonna and Rice Krispies and peanut butter. You know, I mean, well, I don't have a great cultural heritage, okay? So I'm kind of envious of that young boy.
Well, it was good of his parents to not cut his hair and stick to their guns. But then the principal actually said, because they braided his hair, can you tuck it in his shirt? And they said, no, we're not going to tuck his hair in his shirt. He needs to go to school. I mean, this was this kid's first day of school ever that he'll ever have in his life. And he was sent home because of his hair. How's that going to make him feel for the rest of his educational career? How the principal sent him home for how he looks because he looks like an Indian. And then they were like, well, go prove you're Native American. So they had to go get proof of how they are genetically. Although, well, you're in a special category now and you might be exempt and allowed to have this kind of haircut. It's totally ridiculous. He ought to put ribbons in it just to mess with them. Or maybe point to, I don't know, the dollar or the nickel or any of our founding fathers who had long hair, or Ben Franklin on the $100 bill, and say, What are these, a bunch of sissies too? Are these little girls too? Not that women are sissies, but that's the worldview of the Texas principle.
Well, it just shows that attitudes, I mean, it's, again, like you said earlier, it's just very selective. There are some things that they're very selective about. You know, a Native American boy has long hair, probably in a ponytail, which I said I would imagine. You have these this young girl saying they've decided that they're boys that decided that they're girls, okay? And everybody in society has to say, okay, you're not a boy, you're a girl. And I would turn around and say, no, there's only two genders. There's one male and female. Now, don't tell me in your value system that this is this and this is this. No, common sense usually rules. You're a boy or a girl, okay? And take it from there. But don't tell me that you're, what is it Google has now or Facebook has now? Like 70.
Well, the U.S. is obsessed with categories and there's a lot of ethnic pride and sense of kind of nationalism because they ascribe behaviors and things to where they're from. And even with zip codes, they do silly stuff like that. But I live abroad and I've just experienced a lot more personal freedom since I moved than when I lived in the U.S. And I was wondering what your experience has been because you've been living abroad for a long time and contrasting that with the U.S. Because I'm Reagan youth. I didn't get to experience the 60s or anything. I don't know if you did or not, but how has your experience been with social freedoms?
It's really interesting to kind of go full circle here. In Russia, again, people, when I tell people this, that have never been to Russia or don't know much about it, is that, you know, as far as social behavior, I feel so much freer and relaxed in Russia because I'm not, in America, I always felt like, you know, at a certain age, you have to do a certain thing, you have to dress a certain way, talk a certain way, earn enough money a certain way, all this stuff, everything is so categorized. And here, I'm just kind of doing my own thing and I can do whatever I want to do. I mean, there are laws, you don't break the laws, but I don't do that. But I can say what I want to say, I can act the way I want to act, and I don't feel like I'm pigeonholed here. And I do very much so in the United States because I find there's so much conformity in the U.S. And if you don't conform, well, the incarceration rate is quite high in the United States, as we both know.
But with the rhetoric I've seen on TV, isn't it hard for homosexuals in Russia? Aren't they all hiding under every rock and scared to come out?
Well, I mean, you know, again, going back to the issue of a gay lifestyle and gay attitudes, I mean, a man, I've seen it. I've seen men walk down the street wearing high heels and a dress, then nobody stops them. I mean, people give them looks, okay? Like, whoa, that's strange. It's not illegal. You're not probably going to be harassed.
Yeah, but in Russia, you can't criticize the government.
And that's one of the great exaggerations about Russia in Western media, is that it is far more laissez-faire here than they could ever imagine. Like, there's no freedom of speech. You know, if 80%, I'm talking about this with a couple of my good Russian friends, 80% of the quality press in Russia is anti-Putin. 80%. But that's not possible, Peter. It's not possible. There's no dissent in Russia. There's plenty of dissent. There are plenty of columns in the newspapers and on websites criticizing Putin's policy on the economy, on pensions, on Ukraine, and they keep on writing. Why? Because you can. It's not against the law. Now, if you write about you, there should be a forceful overthrow of the constitutional order of Russia, yeah, you're going to get some knocks on your door, like the FBI would to someone in the United States. But...
Well, I find it interesting that you can criticize Obama, but you can't criticize Israel. That'll get you to lose your job. I think that lets everyone know who's really in control and in charge of everything.
Yeah, I've always told people that, you know, American politics is this, you know, this binary, guns and Jews. Be careful on both, okay? Because then you'll get yourself in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, you can't criticize either, and it's not Jews, it's Israel, but of course they paint it as Jews. That's their defense.
Yeah, I mean, particularly, what's her name?
You mean not Hillary?
Yeah, exactly. What's senator, she just came out, she's like going to be the great hope against Hillary Clinton. What is she? She's that former professor. What's her name?
Elizabeth Warren.
And she just came out saying that she sided with Israel on Gaza, which is just, you know, again, it just shows the intimidation, the huge intimidation of just never say what you really think. Okay, always check with what everybody else says and just follow the party line. It's really, again, you know, I like living where I live because I don't have to worry about those things. I don't have to worry about saying the right thing to please people all the time. I just say what comes to mind. I don't have to double think myself at work or in my everyday life at all.
Yeah, but Peter, you're just carrying water for Vladimir Putin. I know, because I saw it on CNN, and CNN would never lie.
Okay. Well, I would prefer to carry water for the truth than to carry water for corporate America and corporate television. So there, Chris Cuomo, that's, you know, that's my touche.
Hey, don't be mean to Chris. It's not like he got his job through nepotism.
And I got my job through I got my job out of hard work, simply hard work.
Well, I appreciate you being brave enough to be coming on this show because, as you know, I've been accused of aiding persons in Syria from the U.S. government, which has shut down my PayPal account over this nonsense. So you might be talking to a terrorist sympathizer. The most ironic thing about that being that the U.S. government actually does finance terrorism.
It's, yeah. I mean, I wrote an article for Voice of Russia, and it had Syria in it, and I didn't get paid for like 8 weeks because somebody flagged it as I was writing pro-Syrian propaganda. Can you imagine?
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. I'm living it.
All right, it's always a pleasure to come on. Let's do it again soon. I really enjoy it a lot, okay? So you take care of yourself.
You too. Take those dogs out and watch Rocky IV.
Will do. All righty, bye-bye.